Book 2, Chapter 19. The day was fresh with a lively spring wind full of dust. All the old ladies in both families had got out their faded sables and yellowing ermines, and the smell of camphor from the front pews almost smothered the faint spring scent of the lilies banking the altar. Newland Archer, at a signal from the sexton, had come out of the vestry and placed himself with his best man on the chancel step of Grace Church. The signal meant that the brougham bearing the bride and her father was in sight, and there was sure to be a considerable interval of adjustment and consultation in the lobby, where the bridesmaids were already hovering like a cluster of Easter blossoms. During this unavoidable lapse of time, the bridegroom, in proof of his eagerness, was expected to expose himself alone to the gaze of the assembled company, and Archer had gone through this formality as resignedly as through all the others, which made of a 19th-century New York wedding a rite that seemed to belong to the dawn of history. Everything was equally easy, or equally painful, as one chose to put it, in the path he was committed to tread, and he had obeyed the flurried injunctions of his best man as piously as other bridegrooms had obeyed his own in the days when he had guided them through the same labyrinth. So far he was reasonably sure of having fulfilled all his obligations. The bridesmaids' 8 bouquets of white lilac and lilies of the valley had been sent in due time, as well as the gold and sapphire sleeve links of the 8 ushers and the best man's cat's-eye scarf-pin. Archer had sat up half the night trying to vary the wording of his thanks for the last batch of presents from men-friends and ex-lady loves. The fees for the bishop and the rector were safely in the pocket of his best man. His own luggage was already at Mrs. Manson Mingott's, where the wedding breakfast was to take place, and so were the traveling clothes into which he was to change, and a private compartment had been engaged in the train that was to carry the young couple to their unknown destination, concealment of the spot in which the bridal night was to be spent being one of the most sacred taboos of the prehistoric ritual. "Got the ring all right?" whispered young van der Luyden Newland, who was inexperienced in the duties of a best man and awed by the weight of his responsibility. Archer made the gesture which he had seen so many bridegrooms make. With his ungloved right hand he felt in the pocket of his dark gray waistcoat and assured himself that the little gold circlet engraved inside Newland to May, April, blank, 187, blank, was in its place. Then, resuming his former attitude, his tall hat and pearl-gray gloves with black stitchings grasped in his left hand, he stood looking at the door of the church. Overhead, Handel's march swelled pompously through the imitation stone vaulting, carrying on its waves the faded drift of the many weddings at which, with cheerful indifference, he had stood on the same chancel step, watching other brides float up the nave toward other bridegrooms. "How like a first night at the opera," he thought, recognizing all the same faces in the same boxes, no pews, and wondering if, when the last trump sounded, Mrs. Selfridge Mary would be there with the same towering ostrich feathers in her bonnet, and Mrs. Beaufort with the same diamond earrings and the same smile, and whether suitable proscenium seats were already prepared for them in another world. After that there was still time to review one by one the familiar countenances in the first rows, the women's sharp with curiosity and excitement, the men's sulky with the obligation of having to put on their frock coats before luncheon and fight for food at the wedding breakfast. "Too bad the breakfast is at old Catherine's," the bridegroom could fancy Reggie Chivers saying, "but I'm told that Lovell Mingott insisted on its being cooked by his own chef, so it ought to be good if one can only get at it." And he could imagine Sillerton Jackson adding with authority, "My dear fellow, haven't you heard? It's to be served at small tables in the new English fashion." Archer's eyes lingered a moment on the left-hand pew where his mother, who had entered the church on Mr. Henry van der Luyden's arm, sat weeping softly under her Chantilly veil, her hands in her grandmother's ermine muff. "Poor Janie," he thought, looking at his sister. "Even by screwing her head around, she can see only the people in the few front pews. and they're mostly dowdy Newlands and Dagonets. On the hither side of the white ribbon dividing off the seats reserved for the families, he saw Beaufort, tall and red-faced, scrutinizing the women with his arrogant stare. Beside him sat his wife, all silvery chinchilla and violets, and on the far side of the ribbon, Lawrence Lefferts' sleekly brushed head seemed to mount guard over the invisible deity of good form who presided at the ceremony. Archer wondered how many flaws Lefferts' keen eyes would discover in the ritual of his divinity. Then he suddenly recalled that he, too, had once thought such questions important. The things that had filled his days seemed now like a nursery parody of life, or like the wrangles of medieval schoolmen over metaphysical terms that nobody had ever understood. A stormy discussion as to whether the wedding presents should be shown had darkened the last hours before the wedding, and it seemed inconceivable to Archer that grown-up people should work themselves into a state of agitation over such trifles, and that the matter should have been decided in the negative by Mrs. Welland saying with indignant tears, "I should as soon turn the reporters loose in my house." Yet there was a time when Archer had had definite and rather aggressive opinions on all such problems, and when everything concerning the manners and customs of his little tribe had seemed to him fraught with worldwide significance. And all the while, I suppose, he thought, real people were living somewhere, and real things happening to them. "There they come," breathed the best man excitedly. But the bridegroom knew better. The cautious opening of the door of the church meant only that Mr. Brown, the livery stable keeper, gowned in black in his intermittent character of sexton, was taking a preliminary survey of the scene before marshalling his forces. The door was softly shut again. Then, after another interval, it swung majestically open, and a murmur ran through the church. "The family!" Mrs. Welland came first on the arm of her eldest son. Her large pink face was appropriately solemn, and her plum-colored satin with pale blue side panels and blue ostrich plumes in a small satin bonnet met with general approval. But before she had settled herself with a stately rustle in the pew opposite Mrs. Archer's, the spectators were craning their necks to see who was coming after her. Wild rumors had been abroad the day before to the effect that Mrs. Manson Mingott, in spite of her physical disabilities, had resolved on being present at the ceremony. And the idea was so much in keeping with her sporting character that bets ran high at the clubs as to her being able to walk up the nave and squeeze into a seat. It was known that she had insisted on sending her own carpenter to look into the possibility of taking down the end panel of the front pew, and to measure the space between the seat and the front. But the result had been discouraging, and for one anxious day her family had watched her dallying with the plan of being wheeled up the nave in her enormous bath chair and sitting enthroned in it at the foot of the chancel. The idea of this monstrous exposure of her person was so painful to her relations that they could have covered with gold the ingenious person who suddenly discovered that the chair was too wide to pass between the iron uprights of the awning which extended from the church door to the curbstone. The idea of doing away with this awning and revealing the bride to the mob of dressmakers and newspaper reporters who stood outside fighting to get near the joints of the canvas exceeded even old Catherine's courage, though for a moment she had weighed the possibility. "Why, they might take a photograph of my child and put it in the papers," Mrs. Welland exclaimed when her mother's last plan was hinted to her, and from this unthinkable indecency the clan recoiled with a collective shudder. The ancestress had had to give in, but her concession was bought only by the promise that the wedding breakfast should take place under her roof, though, as the Washington Square connection said, with the Wellands' house in easy reach, it was hard to have to make a special price with Brown to drive one to the other end of nowhere. Though all these transactions had been widely reported by the Jacksons, a sporting minority still clung to the belief that old Catherine would appear in church, and there was a distinct lowering of the temperature when she was found to have been replaced by her daughter-in-law. Mrs. Lovell Mingott had the high color and glassy stare induced in ladies of her age and habit by the effort of getting into a new dress. But once the disappointment occasioned by her mother-in-law's non-appearance had subsided, it was agreed that her black chantilly over lilac satin with a bonnet of Parma violets formed the happiest contrast to Mrs. Welland's blue and plum color. Far different was the impression produced by the gaunt and mincing lady who followed on Mr. Mingott's arm, in a wild dishevelment of stripes and fringes and floating scarves. And as this last apparition glided into view, Archer's heart contracted and stopped beating. He had taken it for granted that the Marchioness Manson was still in Washington, where she had gone some 4 weeks previously with her niece, Madame Olenska. It was generally understood that their abrupt departure was due to Madame Olenska's desire to remove her aunt from the baleful eloquence of Dr. Agathon Carver, who had nearly succeeded in enlisting her as a recruit for the Valley of Love. And in the circumstances, no one had expected either of the ladies to return for the wedding. For a moment, Archer stood with his eyes fixed on Medora's fantastic figure, straining to see who came behind her. But the little procession was at an end, for all the lesser members of the family had taken their seats, and the eight tall ushers, gathering themselves together like birds or insects preparing for some migratory maneuver, were already slipping through the side doors into the lobby.
"Newland, I say, she's here,"
the best man whispered. Archer roused himself with a start. A long time had apparently passed since his heart had stopped beating, for the white and rosy procession was, in fact, halfway up the nave. The bishop, the rector, and two white-winged assistants were hovering about the flower-banked altar, and the first chords of the Spore Symphony were strewing their flower-like notes before the bride. Archer opened his eyes, but could they really have been shut, as he imagined? And felt his heart begin to resume its usual task. The music, the scent of the lilies on the altar, the vision of the cloud of tulle and orange blossoms floating nearer and nearer, the sight of Mrs. Archer's face suddenly convulsed with happy sobs, the low benedictory murmur of the rector's voice, the ordered evolutions of the eight pink bridesmaids and the eight black ushers, all these sights, sounds, and sensations, so familiar in themselves, so unutterably strange and meaningless in his new relation to them, were confusedly mingled in his brain. "My God," he thought, "have I got the ring?" And once more he went through the bridegroom's convulsive gesture. Then, in a moment, May was beside him, such radiance streaming from her that it sent a faint warmth through his numbness, and he straightened himself and smiled into her eyes. "Dearly beloved, we are gathered together here," the rector began. The ring was on her hand, the bishop's benediction had been given, the bridesmaids were appoised to resume their place in the procession, and the organ was showing preliminary symptoms of breaking out into the Mendelssohn March, without which no newly wedded couple had ever emerged upon New York.
"Your arm! I say, give her your arm!" young Newland nervously hissed.
And once more Archer became aware of having been adrift far off in the unknown. What was it that had sent him there, he wondered? Perhaps the glimpse, among the anonymous spectators in the transept, of a dark coil of hair under a hat, which a moment later revealed itself as belonging to an unknown lady with a long nose, so laughably unlike the person whose image she had evoked, that he asked himself if he were becoming subject to hallucinations. And now he and his wife were pacing slowly down the nave, carried forth on the light Mendelssohn ripples, the spring day beckoning to them through widely opened doors, and Mrs. Welland's chestnuts, with big white favors on their frontlets, curvetting and showing off at the far end of the canvas tunnel. The footman, who had a still bigger white favor on his lapel, wrapped May's white cloak about her, and Archer jumped into the brougham at her side. She turned to him with a triumphant smile, and their hands clasped under her veil.
"Darling," Archer said.
And suddenly the same black abyss yawned before him, and he felt himself sinking into it deeper and deeper, while his voice rambled on, smoothly and cheerfully.
"Yes, of course I thought I'd lost the ring. No wedding would be complete if the poor devil of a bridegroom didn't go through that. But you did keep me waiting, you know. I had time to think of every horror that might possibly happen."
She surprised him by turning in full Fifth Avenue and flinging her arms about his neck. "But none ever can happen now, can it, Newland, as long as we two are together?" Every detail of the day had been so carefully thought out that the young couple, after the wedding breakfast, had ample time to put on their traveling clothes, descend the wide Mingott stairs between laughing bridesmaids and weeping parents, and get into the brougham under the traditional shower of rice and satin slippers, and there was still half an hour left in which to drive to the station, buy the last weeklies at the bookstall with the air of seasoned travelers, and settle themselves in the reserved compartment in which May's maid had already placed her dove-colored traveling cloak and glaringly new dressing bag from London. The old Dulac aunts at Rhinebeck had put their house at the disposal of the bridal couple, with a readiness inspired by the prospect of spending a week in New York with Mrs. Archer. And Archer, glad to escape the usual bridal suite in a Philadelphia or Baltimore hotel, had accepted with an equal alacrity. May was enchanted at the idea of going to the country, and childishly amused at the vain efforts of the eight bridesmaids to discover where their mysterious retreat was situated. It was thought very English to have a country house lent to one, and the fact gave a last touch of distinction to what was generally conceded to be the most brilliant wedding of the year. But where the house was, no one was permitted to know, except the parents of bride and groom, who, when taxed with the knowledge, pursed their lips and said mysteriously, "They didn't tell us," which was manifestly true, since there was no need to. Once they were settled in their compartment and the train, shaking off the endless wooden suburbs, had pushed out into the pale landscape of spring, talk became easier than Archer had expected. May was still, in look and tone, the simple girl of yesterday, eager to compare notes with him as to the incidents of the wedding, and discussing them as impartially as a bridesmaid talking it all over with an usher. At first Archer had fancied that this detachment was the disguise of an inward tremor, but her clear eyes revealed only the most tranquil unawareness. She was alone for the first time with her husband, but her husband was only the charming comrade of yesterday. There was no one whom she liked as much, no one whom she trusted as completely, and the culminating lark of the whole delightful adventure of engagement and marriage was to be off with him alone on a journey, like a grown-up person, like a married woman, in fact. It was wonderful that, as he had learned in the Mission Garden of St. Augustine, such depths of feeling could coexist with such absence of imagination. But he remembered how even then she had surprised him by dropping back to inexpressive girlishness as soon as her conscience had been eased of its burden, and he saw that she would probably go through life dealing to the best of her ability with each experience as it came, but never anticipating any by so much as a stolen glance. Perhaps that faculty of unawareness was what gave her eyes their transparency, and her face the look of representing a type rather than a person, as if she might have been chosen to pose for a civic virtue or a Greek goddess. The blood that ran so close to her fair skin might have been a preserving fluid rather than a ravaging element. Yet her look of indestructible youthfulness made her seem neither hard nor dull, but only primitive and pure. In the thick of this meditation, Archer suddenly felt himself looking at her with the startled gaze of a stranger,
and plunged into a reminiscence of the wedding breakfast and of Granny Mingott's immense and triumphant pervasion of it. May settled down to frank enjoyment of the subject. I was surprised, though, weren't you, that Aunt Medora came after all? Ellen wrote that they were neither of them well enough to take the journey. I do wish it had been she who had recovered. Did you see the exquisite old lace she sent me? He had known that the moment must come sooner or later, but he had somehow imagined that by force of willing he might hold it at bay. Yes, yes, it was beautiful, he said, looking at her blindly, and wondering if, whenever he heard those two syllables, all his carefully built-up world would tumble about him like a house of cards. Aren't you tired? It will be good to have some tea when we arrive. I'm sure the aunts have got everything beautifully ready. He rattled on, taking her hand in his, and his mind rushed away instantly to the magnificent tea and coffee service of Baltimore silver which the Beauforts had sent, and which went so perfectly with Uncle Lovell Mingott's trays and side dishes. In the spring twilight the train stopped at the Rhinebeck station, and they walked along the platform to the waiting carriage. "Ah, how awfully kind of the Van der Luydens. They've sent their man over from Skuytercliff to meet us," Archer exclaimed, as a sedate person out of livery approached them and relieved the maid of her bags. "I'm extremely sorry, sir," said this emissary, "that a little accident has occurred at the Miss du Lac's, a leak in the water tank. It happened yesterday, and Mr. Van der Luyden, who heard of it this morning, sent a housemaid up by the early train to get the patroon's house ready. It will be quite comfortable, I think you'll find, sir. And the Miss du Lac's have sent their cook over so that it will be exactly the same as if you'd been at Rhinebeck." Archer stared at the speaker so blankly that he repeated in still more apologetic accents, "It'll be exactly the same, sir, I do assure you." And May's eager voice broke out, covering the embarrassed silence. "The same as Rhinebeck? The patroon's house? But it will be 100,000 times better, won't it, Newland? It's too dear and kind of Mr. Van Luyden to have thought of it." And as they drove off, with the maid beside the coachman and their shining bridal bags on the seat before them, she went on excitedly. "Only fancy! I've never been inside it, have you? The Van der Luydens show it to so few people. But they opened it for Ellen, it seems, and she told me what a darling little place it was. She says it's the only house she's seen in America that she could imagine being perfectly happy in." "Well, that's what we're going to be, isn't it?" cried her husband gaily, and she answered with her boyish smile. "Ah, it's just our luck beginning, the wonderful luck we're always going to have together." Chapter 20. "Of course we must dine with Mrs. Carfrey, dearest," Archer said, and his wife looked at him with an anxious frown across the monumental Britannia ware of their lodging-house breakfast table. In all the rainy desert of autumnal London there were only two people whom the Newland Archers knew, and these two they had sedulously avoided in conformity with the old New York tradition that it was not dignified to force oneself on the notice of one's acquaintances in foreign countries. Mrs. Archer and Janie, in the course of their visits to Europe, had so unflinchingly lived up to this principle, and met the friendly advances of their fellow travelers with an air of such impenetrable reserve, that they had almost achieved the record of never having exchanged a word with a foreigner other than those employed in hotels and railway stations. Their own compatriots, save those previously known or properly accredited, they treated with an even more pronounced disdain, so that, unless they ran across a Chivers, a Dagonet, or a Mingott, their months abroad were spent in an unbroken tête-à-tête. But the utmost precautions are sometimes unavailing, and one night at Botzen, one of the two English ladies in the room across the passage, whose names, dress, and social situation were already intimately known to Janie, had knocked on the door and asked if Mrs. Archer had a bottle of liniment. The other lady, the intruder's sister, Mrs. Carfrey, had been seized with a sudden attack of bronchitis, and Mrs. Archer, who never traveled without a complete family pharmacy, was fortunately able to produce the required remedy. Mrs. Carfrey was very ill, and as she and her sister, Miss Harle, were traveling alone, they were profoundly grateful to the Archer ladies, who supplied them with ingenious comforts and whose efficient maid helped to nurse the invalid back to health. When the Archers left Botzen, they had no idea of ever seeing Mrs. Carfrey and Miss Harle again. Nothing, to Mrs. Archer's mind, would have been more undignified than to force oneself on the notice of a foreigner to whom one had happened to render an accidental service. But Mrs. Carfrey and her sister, to whom this point of view was unknown, and who would have found it utterly incomprehensible, felt themselves linked by an eternal gratitude to the delightful Americans who had been so kind at Botzen. With touching fidelity, they seized every chance of meeting Mrs. Archer and Janie in the course of their continental travels, and displayed a supernatural acuteness in finding out when they were to pass through London on their way to or from the States. The intimacy became indissoluble, and Mrs. Archer and Janie, whenever they alighted at Brown's Hotel, found themselves awaited by two affectionate friends who, like themselves, cultivated ferns in Wardian cases, made macrame lace, read the memoirs of the Baroness Bunsen, and had views about the occupants of the leading London pulpits. As Mrs. Archer said, it made another thing of London to know Mrs. Carfrey and Miss Harle, and by the time that Newland became engaged, the tie between the families was so firmly established that it was thought only right to send a wedding invitation to the two English ladies, who sent in return a pretty bouquet of pressed alpine flowers under glass. And on the dock, when Newland and his wife sailed for England, Mrs. Archer's last word had been, "You must take May to see Mrs. Carfrey." Newland and his wife had had no idea of obeying this injunction, but Mrs. Carfrey, with her usual acuteness, had run them down and sent them an invitation to dine. And it was over this invitation that May Archer was wrinkling her brows across the tea and muffins. "It's all very well for you, Newland. You know them. But I shall feel so shy among a lot of people I've never met. And what shall I wear?" Newland leaned back in his chair and smiled at her. She looked handsomer and more Diana-like than ever. The moist English air seemed to have deepened the bloom of her cheeks and softened the slight hardness of her virginal features. Or else it was simply the inner glow of happiness, shining through like a light under ice. "Where, dearest? I thought a trunk full of things had come from Paris last week."
"Yes, of course. I meant to say that I shan't know which to wear."
She pouted a little.
"I've never dined out in London, and I don't want to be ridiculous."
He tried to enter into her perplexity. "But don't English women dress just like everybody else in the evening?"
"Newland, how can you ask such funny questions? When they go to the theater in old ball dresses and bare heads?"
"Well, perhaps they wear new ball dresses at home. But at any rate, Mrs. Carfrey and Miss Harle won't. They'll wear caps like my mother's and shawls, very soft shawls."
"Yes, but how will the other women be dressed?"
"Not as well as you, dear," he rejoined, wondering what had suddenly developed in her Janie's morbid interest in clothes. She pushed back her chair with a sigh.
"That's dear of you, Newland, but it doesn't help me much."
He had an inspiration. "Why not wear your wedding dress? That can't be wrong, can it?"
"Oh, dearest, if I only had it here! But it's gone to Paris to be made over for next winter, and Worth hasn't sent it back."
"Oh, well," said Archer, getting up. "Look here, the fog's lifting. If we made a dash for the National Gallery, we might manage to catch a glimpse of the pictures."
The Newland Archers were on their way home after a 3 months wedding tour, which May, in writing to her girlfriends, vaguely summarized as blissful. They had not gone to the Italian lakes. On reflection, Archer had not been able to picture his wife in that particular setting. Her own inclination, after a month with the Paris dressmakers, was for mountaineering in July and swimming in August. This plan they punctually fulfilled, spending July in Interlaken and Grindelwald, and August at a little place called Etretat on the Normandy coast, which someone had recommended as quaint and quiet. Once or twice in the mountains, Archer had pointed southward and said, "There's Italy." And May, her feet in a gentian bed, had smiled cheerfully and replied, "It would be lovely to go there next winter, if only you didn't have to be in New York." But in reality, traveling interested her even less than he had expected. She regarded it, once her clothes were ordered, as merely an enlarged opportunity for walking, riding, swimming, and trying her hand at the fascinating new game of lawn tennis. And when they finally got back to London, where they were to spend a fortnight while he ordered his clothes, she was no longer concealing the eagerness with which she looked forward to sailing. In London, nothing interested her but the theatres and the shops, and she found the theatres less exciting than the Paris Café Chantant, where, under the blossoming horse-chestnuts of the Champs-Élysées, she had had the novel experience of looking down from the restaurant terrace on an audience of cocottes, and having her husband interpret to her as much of the songs as he thought suitable for bridal ears. Archer had reverted to all his old inherited ideas about marriage. It was less trouble to conform with the tradition and treat May exactly as all his friends treated their wives than to try to put into practice the theories with which his untrammeled bachelorhood had dallied. There was no use in trying to emancipate a wife who had not the dimmest notion that she was not free. And he had long since discovered that May's only use of the liberty she supposed herself to possess would be to lay it on the altar of her wifely adoration. Her innate dignity would always keep her from making the gift abjectly. And a day might even come, as it once had, when she would find strength to take it altogether back if she thought she were doing it for his own good. But with a conception of marriage so uncomplicated and incurious as hers, such a crisis could be brought about only by something visibly outrageous in his own conduct. And the fineness of her feeling for him made that unthinkable. Whatever happened, he knew, she would always be loyal, gallant, and unresentful. And that pledged him to the practice of the same virtues. All this tended to draw him back into his old habits of mind. If her simplicity had been the simplicity of pettiness, he would have chafed and rebelled. But since the lines of her character, though so few, were on the same fine mold as her face, she became the tutelary divinity of all his old traditions and reverences. Such qualities were scarcely of the kind to enliven foreign travel, though they made her so easy and pleasant a companion. But he saw at once how they would fall into place in their proper setting. He had no fear of being oppressed by them, for his artistic and intellectual life would go on, as it always had, outside the domestic circle. And within it there would be nothing small and stifling. Coming back to his wife would never be like entering a stuffy room after a tramp in the open. And when they had children, the vacant corners in both their lives would be filled. All these things went through his mind during their long, slow drive from Mayfair to South Kensington, where Mrs. Carfrae and her sister lived. Archer, too, would have preferred to escape their friends' hospitality. In conformity with the family tradition, he had always travelled as a sightseer and looker-on, affecting a haughty unconsciousness of the presence of his fellow beings.
Once only, just after Harvard, he had spent a few gay weeks at Florence with a band of queer Europeanized Americans, dancing all night with titled ladies in palaces and gambling half the day with the rakes and dandies of the fashionable club. But it had all seemed to him, though the greatest fun in the world, as unreal as a carnival. These queer cosmopolitan women, deep in complicated love affairs which they appeared to feel the need of retailing to everyone they met, and the magnificent young officers and elderly dyed wits who were the subjects or the recipients of their confidences, were too different from the people Archer had grown up among, too much like expensive and rather malodorous hothouse exotics to detain his imagination long. To introduce his wife into such a society was out of the question, and in the course of his travels no other had shown any marked eagerness for his company. Not long after their arrival in London he had run across the Duke of St. Austrey, and the Duke, instantly and cordially recognizing him, had said, "Look me up, won't you?" But no proper-spirited American would have considered that a suggestion to be acted on, and the meeting was without a sequel. They had even managed to avoid May's English aunt, the banker's wife, who was still in Yorkshire. In fact, they had purposely postponed going to London till the autumn in order that their arrival during the season might not appear pushing and snobbish to these unknown relatives. "Probably there'll be nobody at Mrs. Carfrey's. London's a desert at this season, and you've made yourself much too beautiful," Archer said to May, who sat at his side in the hansom, so spotlessly splendid in her sky-blue cloak edged with swansdown that it seemed wicked to expose her to the London grime.
"I don't want them to think that we dressed like savages," she replied, with a scorn that Pocahontas might have resented.
And he was struck again by the religious reverence of even the most unworldly American women for the social advantages of dress. "It's their armor," he thought, "their defense against the unknown, and their defiance of it."
And he understood for the first time the earnestness with which May, who was incapable of tying a ribbon in her hair to charm him, had gone through the solemn rite of selecting and ordering her extensive wardrobe. He had been right in expecting the party at Mrs. Carfrey's to be a small one. Besides their hostess and her sister, they found in the long, chilly drawing-room only another shawled lady, a genial vicar who was her husband, a silent lad whom Mrs. Carfrey named as her nephew, and a small, dark gentleman with lively eyes whom she introduced as his tutor, pronouncing a French name as she did so. Into this dimly lit and dim-featured group, May Archer floated like a swan with the sunset on her. She seemed larger, fairer, more voluminously rustling than her husband had ever seen her, and he perceived that the rosiness and rustlingness were the tokens of an extreme and infantile shyness.
"What on earth will they expect me to talk about?" her helpless eyes implored him, at the very moment that her dazzling apparition was calling forth the same anxiety in their own bosoms.
But beauty, even when distrustful of itself, awakens confidence in the manly heart, and the vicar and the French-named tutor were soon manifesting to May their desire to put her at her ease. In spite of their best efforts, however, the dinner was a languishing affair. Archer noticed that his wife's way of showing herself at her ease with foreigners was to become more uncompromisingly local in her references, so that, though her loveliness was an encouragement to admiration, her conversation was a chill to repartee. The vicar soon abandoned the struggle, but the tutor, who spoke the most fluent and accomplished English, gallantly continued to pour it out to her until the ladies, to the manifest relief of all concerned, went up to the drawing-room. The vicar, after a glass of port, was obliged to hurry away to a meeting, and the shy nephew, who appeared to be an invalid, was packed off to bed. But Archer and the tutor continued to sit over their wine, and suddenly Archer found himself talking as he had not done since his last symposium with Ned Winsett.
The Carfree nephew, it turned out, had been threatened with consumption and had had to leave Harrow for Switzerland, where he had spent 2 years in the milder air of Lake Leman. Being a bookish youth, he had been entrusted to Monsieur Riviere, who had brought him back to England and was to remain with him till he went up to Oxford the following spring. And Monsieur Riviere added with simplicity that he should then have to look out for another job. It seemed impossible, Archer thought, that he should be long without one, so varied were his interests and so many his gifts. He was a man of about 30, with a thin, ugly face, May would certainly have called him common-looking, to which the play of his ideas gave an intense expressiveness. But there was nothing frivolous or cheap in his animation. His father, who had died young, had filled a small diplomatic post, and it had been intended that the son should follow the same career. But an insatiable taste for letters had thrown the young man into journalism, then into authorship, apparently unsuccessful, and at length, after other experiments and vicissitudes which he spared his listener, into tutoring English youths in Switzerland. Before that, however, he had lived much in Paris, frequented the Goncourt Grenier, been advised by Maupassant not to attempt to write, even that seemed to Archer a dazzling honor, and had often talked with Merimée in his mother's house. He had obviously always been desperately poor and anxious, having a mother and an unmarried sister to provide for, and it was apparent that his literary ambitions had failed. His situation, in fact, seemed, materially speaking, no more brilliant than Ned Winsett's. But he had lived in a world in which, as he said, no one who loved ideas need hunger mentally. As it was precisely of that love that poor Winsett was starving to death, Archer looked with a sort of vicarious envy at this eager, impecunious young man who had fared so richly in his poverty.
"You see, monsieur, it's worth everything, isn't it, to keep one's intellectual liberty, not to enslave one's powers of appreciation, one's critical independence. It was because of that I abandoned journalism and took to so much duller work, tutoring and private secretaryship. There is a good deal of drudgery, of course, but one preserves one's moral freedom, what we call in French one's compte à soi. And when one hears good talk, one can join in it without compromising any opinions but one's own, or one can listen and answer it inwardly. Ah, good conversation, there's nothing like it, is there? The air of ideas is the only air worth breathing. And so I have never regretted giving up either diplomacy or journalism, two different forms of the same self-abdication.
He fixed his vivid eyes on Archer as he lit another cigarette.
Voyez-vous, monsieur, to be able to look life in the face, that's worth living in a garret for, isn't it? But, after all, one must earn enough to pay for the garret. And I confess that to grow old as a private tutor or a private anything is almost as chilling to the imagination as a second secretaryship at Bucharest. Sometimes I feel I must make a plunge, an immense plunge. Do you suppose, for instance, there would be any opening for me in America, in New York?
Archer looked at him with startled eyes. New York, for a young man who had frequented the Goncourts and Flaubert, and who thought the life of ideas the only one worth living? He continued to stare at Monsieur Riviere perplexedly, wondering how to tell him that his very superiorities and advantages would be the surest hindrance to success.
New York, but must it be especially New York?
He stammered, utterly unable to imagine what lucrative opening his native city could offer to a young man to whom good conversation appeared to be the only necessity. A sudden flush rose under Monsieur Riviere's sallow skin.
I thought it your metropolis. Is not the intellectual life more active there? He rejoined. Then, as if fearing to give his hearer the impression of having asked a favor, he went on hastily. One throws out random suggestions, more to one's self than to others. In reality, I see no immediate prospect. And rising from his seat, he added, without a trace of constraint, But Mrs. Carfrae will think that I ought to be taking you upstairs.
During the homeward drive, Archer pondered deeply on this episode. His hour with Monsieur Riviere had put new air into his lungs, and his first impulse had been to invite him to dine the next day. But he was beginning to understand why married men did not always immediately yield to their first impulses.
That young tutor is an interesting fellow. We had some awfully good talk after dinner about books and things, he threw out tentatively in the hansom.
May roused herself from one of the dreamy silences into which he had read so many meanings before 6 months of marriage had given him the key to them.
The little Frenchman? Wasn't he dreadfully common? She questioned coldly,
and he guessed that she nursed a secret disappointment at having been invited out in London to meet a clergyman and a French tutor. The disappointment was not occasioned by the sentiment ordinarily defined as snobbishness, but by old New York's sense of what was due to it when it risked its dignity in foreign lands. If May's parents had entertained the Carfrees in Fifth Avenue, they would have offered them something more substantial than a parson and a schoolmaster. But Archer was on edge and took her up.
Common? Common where? He queried,
and she returned with unusual readiness. Why, I should say anywhere but in his schoolroom. Those people are always awkward in society. But then, she added disarmingly, I suppose I shouldn't have known if he was clever. Archer disliked her use of the word clever almost as much as her use of the word common. But he was beginning to fear his tendency to dwell on the things he disliked in her. After all, her point of view had always been the same. It was that of all the people he had grown up among, and he had always regarded it as necessary but negligible. Until a few months ago, he had never known a nice woman who looked at life differently. And if a man married, it must necessarily be among the nice.
Ah, then I won't ask him to dine, he concluded with a laugh.
And May echoed, bewildered, Goodness, ask the Carfrees' tutor?
Well, not on the same day with the Carfrees, if you prefer I shouldn't. But I did rather want another talk with him. He's looking for a job in New York.
Her surprise increased with her indifference. He almost fancied that she suspected him of being tainted with foreignness. A job in New York? What sort of a job? People don't have French tutors. What does he want to do?
Chiefly to enjoy good conversation, I understand. Her husband retorted perversely, and she broke into an appreciative laugh.
Oh, Newland, how funny! Isn't that French?
On the whole, he was glad to have the matter settled for him by her refusing to take seriously his wish to invite Monsieur Riviere. Another after-dinner talk would have made it difficult to avoid the question of New York, and the more Archer considered it, the less he was able to fit Monsieur Riviere into any conceivable picture of New York as he knew it. He perceived with a flash of chilling insight that in future many problems would be thus negatively solved for him. But as he paid the hansom and followed his wife's long train into the house, he took refuge in the comforting platitude that the first 6 months were always the most difficult in marriage.
After that, I suppose we shall have pretty nearly finished rubbing off each other's angles, he reflected.
But the worst of it was that May's pressure was already bearing on the very angles whose sharpness he most wanted to keep.
Chapter 21
The small, bright lawn stretched away smoothly to the big, bright sea. The turf was hemmed with an edge of scarlet geranium and coleus, and cast-iron vases, painted in chocolate colors, standing at intervals along the winding path that led to the sea, looped their garlands of petunia and ivy geranium above the neatly raked gravel. Halfway between the edge of the cliff and the square wooden house, which was also chocolate-colored, but with the tin roof of the veranda striped in yellow and brown to represent an awning, two large targets had been placed against a background of shrubbery. On the other side of the lawn, facing the targets, was pitched a real tent with benches and garden seats about it. A number of ladies in summer dresses and gentlemen in gray frock coats and tall hats stood on the lawn or sat upon the benches, and every now and then a slender girl in starched muslin would step from the tent, bow in hand, and speed her shaft at one of the targets, while the spectators interrupted their talk to watch the result. Newland Archer, standing on the veranda of the house, looked curiously down upon this scene. On each side of the shiny painted steps was a large blue china flower pot on a bright yellow china stand. A spiky green plant filled each pot, and below the veranda ran a wide border of blue hydrangeas edged with more red geraniums. Behind him, the French windows of the drawing rooms through which he had passed gave glimpses, between swaying lace curtains, of glassy parquet floors islanded with chintz poufs, dwarf armchairs, and velvet tables covered with trifles in silver. The Newport Archery Club always held its August meeting at the Beauforts. The sport, which had hitherto known no rival but croquet, was beginning to be discarded in favor of lawn tennis, but the latter game was still considered too rough and inelegant for social occasions, and as an opportunity to show off pretty dresses and graceful attitudes, the bow and arrow held their own. Archer looked down with wonder at the familiar spectacle. It surprised him that life should be going on in the old way when his own reactions to it had so completely changed. It was Newport that had first brought home to him the extent of the change. In New York, during the previous winter, after he and May had settled down in the new greenish-yellow house with the bow window and the Pompeian vestibule, he had dropped back with relief into the old routine of the office, and the renewal of this daily activity had served as a link with his former self. Then there had been the pleasurable excitement of choosing a showy gray stepper for May's brougham, the Wellands had given the carriage, and the abiding occupation and interest of arranging his new library, which, in spite of family doubts and disapprovals, had been carried out as he had dreamed, with a dark embossed paper, Eastlake bookcases, and sincere armchairs and tables. At the Century he had found Winsett again, and at the Knickerbocker the fashionable young men of his own set. And what with the hours dedicated to the law and those given to dining out or entertaining friends at home, with an occasional evening at the opera or the play, the life he was living had still seemed a fairly real and inevitable sort of business. But Newport represented the escape from duty into an atmosphere of unmitigated holiday-making. Archer had tried to persuade May to spend the summer on a remote island off the coast of Maine, called, appropriately enough, Mount Desert, where a few hardy Bostonians and Philadelphians were camping in native cottages, and whence came reports of enchanting scenery and a wild, almost trapper-like existence amid woods and waters. But the Wellands always went to Newport, where they owned one of the square boxes on the cliffs, and their son-in-law could adduce no good reason why he and May should not join them there. As Mrs. Welland rather tartly pointed out, it was hardly worthwhile for May to have worn herself out trying on summer clothes in Paris if she was not to be allowed to wear them. And this argument was of a kind to which Archer had as yet found no answer. May herself could not understand his obscure reluctance to fall in with so reasonable and pleasant a way of spending the summer. She reminded him that he had always liked Newport in his bachelor days, and as this was indisputable, he could only profess that he was sure he was going to like it better than ever now that they were to be there together.
But as he stood on the Beaufort veranda and looked out on the brightly peopled lawn, it came home to him with a shiver that he was not going to like it at all. It was not May's fault, poor dear, if now and then during their travels they had fallen slightly out of step, harmony had been restored by their return to the conditions she was used to. He had always foreseen that she would not disappoint him, and he had been right. He had married, as most young men did, because he had met a perfectly charming girl at the moment when a series of rather aimless sentimental adventures were ending in premature disgust, and she had represented peace, stability, comradeship, and the steadying sense of an unescapable duty. He could not say that he had been mistaken in his choice, for she had fulfilled all that he had expected. It was undoubtedly gratifying to be the husband of one of the handsomest and most popular young married women in New York, especially when she was also one of the sweetest tempered and most reasonable of wives. And Archer had never been insensible to such advantages. As for the momentary madness which had fallen upon him on the eve of his marriage, he had trained himself to regard it as the last of his discarded experiments. The idea that he could ever in his senses have dreamed of marrying the Countess Olenska had become almost unthinkable, and she remained in his memory simply as the most plaintive and poignant of a line of ghosts. But all of these abstractions and eliminations made of his mind a rather empty and echoing place, and he supposed that was one of the reasons why the busy, animated people on the Beaufort lawn shocked him as if they had been children playing in a graveyard. He heard a murmur of skirts beside him, and the Marchioness Manson fluttered out of the drawing-room window. As usual, she was extraordinarily festooned and bedizened, with a limp leghorn hat anchored to her head by many windings of faded gauze, and a little black velvet parasol on a carved ivory handle absurdly balanced over her much larger hat-brim. "My dear Newland, I had no idea that you and May had arrived. You yourself came only yesterday, you say. Ah, business, business, professional duties, I understand. Many husbands, I know, find it impossible to join their wives here except for the weekend." She cocked her head on one side and languished at him through screwed-up eyes. "But marriage is one long sacrifice, as I used often to remind my Ellen." Archer's heart stopped with the queer jerk which it had given once before, and which seemed suddenly to slam a door between himself and the outer world. But this break of continuity must have been of the briefest, for he presently heard Medora answering a question he had apparently found voice to put. "No, I am not staying here, but with the Blankers in their delicious solitude at Portsmouth. Beaufort was kind enough to send his famous trotters for me this morning, so that I might have at least a glimpse of one of Regina's garden parties. But this evening I go back to rural life. The Blankers, dear original beings, have hired a primitive old farmhouse at Portsmouth, where they gather about them representative people." She drooped slightly beneath her protecting brim and added with a faint blush, "This week Dr. Agathon Carver is holding a series of inner thought meetings there. A contrast, indeed, to this gay scene of worldly pleasure. But then I have always lived on contrasts. To me the only death is monotony. I always say to Ellen, 'Beware of monotony. It's the mother of all the deadly sins.' But my poor child is going through a phase of exaltation, of abhorrence of the world. You know, I suppose, that she has declined all invitations to stay at Newport, even with her grandmother Mingott. I could hardly persuade her to come with me to the Blankers, if you will believe it. The life she leads is morbid, unnatural. Ah, if she had only listened to me when it was still possible, when the door was still open. But
Shall we go down and watch this absorbing match? I hear your May is one of the competitors. Strolling toward them from the tent, Beaufort advanced over the lawn, tall, heavy, too tightly buttoned into a London frock coat, with one of his own orchids in its buttonhole. Archer, who had not seen him for 2 or 3 months, was struck by the change in his appearance. In the hot summer light, his floridness seemed heavy and bloated, and but for his erect, square-shouldered walk, he would have looked like an overfed and overdressed old man. There were all sorts of rumors afloat about Beaufort. In the spring, he had gone off on a long cruise to the West Indies in his new steam yacht, and it was reported that, at various points where he had touched, a lady resembling Miss Fanny Ring had been seen in his company. The steam yacht, built in the Clyde and fitted with tiled bathrooms and other unheard-of luxuries, was said to have cost him $500,000, and the pearl necklace which he had presented to his wife on his return was as magnificent as such expiatory offerings are apt to be. Beaufort's fortune was substantial enough to stand the strain, and yet the disquieting rumors persisted, not only in Fifth Avenue, but in Wall Street. Some people said he had speculated, unfortunately, in railways, others that he was being bled by one of the most insatiable members of her profession. And to every report of threatened insolvency, Beaufort replied by a fresh extravagance, the building of a new row of orchid houses, the purchase of a new string of racehorses, or the addition of a new maisonnier or cabanel to his picture gallery. He advanced toward the Marchioness and Newland with his usual half-sneering smile.
"Hello, Medora. Did the trotters do their business? 40 minutes, eh? Well, that's not so bad, considering your nerves had to be spared."
He shook hands with Archer, and then, turning back with them, placed himself on Mrs. Manson's other side, and said in a low voice a few words which their companion did not catch. The Marchioness replied by one of her queer foreign jerks and a "Que voulez-vous?" which deepened Beaufort's frown. But he produced a good semblance of a congratulatory smile as he glanced at Archer to say,
"You know, May's going to carry off the first prize."
"Ah, then it remains in the family," Medora rippled. And at that moment they reached the tent, and Mrs. Beaufort met them in a girlish cloud of mauve muslin and floating veils. May Welland was just coming out of the tent, in her white dress with a pale green ribbon about the waist and a wreath of ivory on her hat. She had the same Diana-like aloofness as when she had entered the Beaufort ballroom on the night of her engagement. In the interval, not a thought seemed to have passed behind her eyes or a feeling through her heart. And though her husband knew that she had the capacity for both, he marveled afresh at the way in which experience dropped away from her. She had her bow and arrow in her hand, and, placing herself on the chalk mark traced on the turf, she lifted the bow to her shoulder and took aim. The attitude was so full of a classic grace that a murmur of appreciation followed her appearance, and Archer felt the glow of proprietorship that so often cheated him into momentary well-being. Her rivals, Mrs. Reggie Chivers, the Merry Girls, and divers Rosy Thorleys, Dagonets, and Mingots, stood behind her in a lovely, anxious group, brown heads and golden bent above the scores, and pale muslins and flower-wreathed hats mingled in a tender rainbow. All were young and pretty and bathed in summer bloom, but not one had the nymph-like ease of his wife when, with tense muscles and happy frown, she bent her soul upon some feat of strength.
"Gad," Archer heard Lawrence Lefferts say, "not one of the lot holds the bow as she does."
And Beaufort retorted,
"Yes, but that's the only kind of target she'll ever hit."
Archer felt irrationally angry. His host's contemptuous tribute to May's niceness was just what a husband should have wished to hear said of his wife. The fact that a coarse-minded man found her lacking in attraction was simply another proof of her quality. Yet the words sent a faint shiver through his heart.
What if niceness carried to that supreme degree were only a negation, the curtain dropped before an emptiness? As he looked at May, returning flushed and calm from her final bullseye, he had the feeling that he had never yet lifted that curtain. She took the congratulations of her rivals and of the rest of the company with the simplicity that was her crowning grace. No one could ever be jealous of her triumphs, because she managed to give the feeling that she would have been just as serene if she had missed them. But when her eyes met her husband's, her face glowed with the pleasure she saw in his. Mrs. Welland's basket-work pony carriage was waiting for them, and they drove off among the dispersing carriages, May handling the reins and Archer sitting at her side. The afternoon sunlight still lingered upon the bright lawns and shrubberies, and up and down Bellevue Avenue rolled a double line of victorias, dog-carts, landaus, and vis-a-vis, carrying well-dressed ladies and gentlemen away from the Beaufort Garden Party, or homeward from their daily afternoon turn along the Ocean Drive. "Shall we go to see Granny?" May suddenly proposed. "I should like to tell her myself that I've won the prize. There's lots of time before dinner." Archer acquiesced, and she turned the ponies down Narragansett Avenue, crossed Spring Street, and drove out toward the rocky moorland beyond. In this unfashionable region, Catherine the Great, always indifferent to precedent and thrifty of purse, had built herself in her youth a many-peaked and cross-beamed cottage ornée on a bit of cheap land overlooking the bay. Here, in a thicket of stunted oaks, her verandas spread themselves above the island-dotted waters. A winding drive led up between iron stags and blue glass balls embedded in mounds of geraniums to a front door of highly varnished walnut under a striped veranda roof. And behind it ran a narrow hall with a black-and-yellow star-patterned parquet floor, upon which opened four small square rooms with heavy flock papers under ceilings on which an Italian house-painter had lavished all the divinities of Olympus. One of these rooms had been turned into a bedroom by Mrs. Mingott when the burden of flesh descended on her, and in the adjoining one she spent her days, enthroned in a large armchair between the open door and window, and perpetually waving a palm-leaf fan which the prodigious projection of her bosom kept so far from the rest of her person that the air it set in motion stirred only the fringe of the antimacassars on the chair-arms. Since she had been the means of hastening his marriage, old Catherine had shown to Archer the cordiality which a service rendered excites toward the person served. She was persuaded that irrepressible passion was the cause of his impatience, and being an ardent admirer of impulsiveness, when it did not lead to the spending of money, she always received him with a genial twinkle of complicity and a play of allusion to which May seemed fortunately impervious. She examined and appraised with much interest the diamond-tipped arrow which had been pinned on May's bosom at the conclusion of the match, remarking that, in her day, a filigree brooch would have been thought enough, but that there was no denying that Beaufort did things handsomely. "Quite an heirloom, in fact, my dear," the old lady chuckled. "You must leave it in fee to your eldest girl." She pinched May's white arm and watched the color flood her face. "Well, well, what have I said to make you shake out the red flag? Ain't there going to be any daughters? Only boys, eh? Good gracious! Look at her blushing again all over her blushes. What? Can't I say that either? Mercy me! When my children beg me to have all those gods and goddesses painted out overhead, I always say I'm too thankful to have somebody about me that nothing can shock." Archer burst into a laugh, and May echoed it, crimson to the eyes. "Well, now, tell me all about the party, please, my dears, for I shall never get a straight word about it out of that silly Medora," the ancestress continued, and as May exclaimed, "Cousin Medora, but I thought she was going back to Portsmouth," she answered placidly. "So she is, but she's got to come here first to pick up Ellen." "Ah, you didn't know Ellen had come to spend the day with me?
Such fal-de-ral, her not coming for the summer. But I gave up arguing with young people about 50 years ago. "Ellen! Ellen!" she cried in her shrill old voice, trying to bend forward far enough to catch a glimpse of the lawn beyond the veranda. There was no answer, and Mrs. Mingott rapped impatiently with her stick on the shiny floor. A mulatto maidservant in a bright turban, replying to the summons, informed her mistress that she had seen Miss Ellen going down the path to the shore, and Mrs. Mingott turned to Archer.
"Run down and fetch her like a good grandson. This pretty lady will describe the party to me," she said,
and Archer stood up as if in a dream. He had heard the Countess Olenska's name pronounced often enough during the year and a half since they had last met, and was even familiar with the main incidents of her life in the interval. He knew that she had spent the previous summer at Newport, where she appeared to have gone a great deal into society, but that in the autumn she had suddenly sublet the perfect house, which Beaufort had been at such pains to find for her, and decided to establish herself in Washington. There, during the winter, he had heard of her, as one always heard of pretty women in Washington, as shining in the brilliant diplomatic society that was supposed to make up for the social shortcomings of the administration. He had listened to these accounts and to various contradictory reports on her appearance, her conversation, her point of view, and her choice of friends, with the detachment with which one listens to reminiscences of someone long since dead. Not till Medora suddenly spoke her name at the archery match had Ellen Olenska become a living presence to him again. The Marchioness's foolish lisp had called up a vision of the little fire-lit drawing-room and the sound of the carriage wheels returning down the deserted street. He thought of a story he had read of some peasant children in Tuscany lighting a bunch of straw in a wayside cavern and revealing old silent images in their painted tomb. The way to the shore descended from the bank on which the house was perched to a walk above the water planted with weeping willows. Through their veil, Archer caught the glint of the lime rock with its whitewashed turret and the little house in which the heroic lighthouse keeper, Ida Lewis, was living her last venerable years. Beyond it lay the flat reaches and ugly government chimneys of Goat Island, the bay spreading northward in a shimmer of gold to Prudence Island with its low growth of oaks, and the shores of Connecticut faint in the sunset haze. From the willow walk projected a slight wooden pier ending in a sort of pagoda-like summer-house, and in the pagoda a lady stood, leaning against the rail, her back to the shore. Archer stopped at the sight as if he had waked from sleep. That vision of the past was a dream, and the reality was what awaited him in the house on the bank overhead, was Mrs. Welland's pony carriage circling around and around the oval at the door, was May sitting under the shameless Olympians and glowing with secret hopes, was the Welland villa at the far end of Bellevue Avenue, and Mr. Welland already dressed for dinner and pacing the drawing-room floor, watch in hand, with dyspeptic impatience. For it was one of the houses in which one always knew exactly what is happening at a given hour. "What am I? A son-in-law?" Archer thought. The figure at the end of the pier had not moved. For a long moment the young man stood halfway down the bank, gazing at the bay furrowed with the coming and going of sailboats, yacht launches, fishing craft, and the trailing black coal barges hauled by noisy tugs. The lady in the summer-house seemed to be held by the same sight. Beyond the gray bastions of Fort Adams, a long-drawn sunset was splintering up into a thousand fires, and the radiance caught the sail of a catboat as it beat out through the channel between the lime rock and the shore. Archer, as he watched, remembered the scene in the Chakran, and Montague lifting Ada Dias's ribbon to his lips without her knowing that he was in the room.
"She doesn't know. She hasn't guessed. Shouldn't I know if she came up behind me, I wonder?" he mused. And suddenly he said to himself, If she doesn't turn before that sail crosses the Lime Rock light, I'll go back. The boat was gliding out on the receding tide. It slid before the Lime Rock, blotted out Ida Lewis's little house, and passed across the turret in which the light was hung. Archer waited till a wide space of water sparkled between the last reef of the island and the stern of the boat. But still the figure in the summer house did not move. He turned and walked up the hill.
"I'm sorry you didn't find Ellen. I should have liked to see her again," May said as they drove home through the dusk. "But perhaps she wouldn't have cared. She seems so changed."
"Changed?" echoed her husband in a colorless voice, his eyes fixed on the pony's twitching ears.
"So indifferent to her friends, I mean. Giving up New York and her house and spending her time with such queer people. Fancy how hideously uncomfortable she must be at the Blenkers. She says she does it to keep Cousin Medora out of mischief, to prevent her marrying dreadful people, but I sometimes think we've always bored her."
Archer made no answer, and she continued with a tinge of hardness that he had never before noticed in her frank, fresh voice.
"After all, I wonder if she wouldn't be happier with her husband."
He burst into a laugh.
"Sancta simplicitas!" he exclaimed,
and as she turned a puzzled frown on him, he added, "I don't think I ever heard you say a cruel thing before."
"Cruel?"
"Well, watching the contortions of the dam is supposed to be a favorite sport of the angels, but I believe even they don't think people happier in hell."
"It's a pity she ever married abroad, then," said May, in the placid tone with which her mother met Mr. Welland's vagaries, and Archer felt himself gently relegated to the category of unreasonable husbands. They drove down Bellevue Avenue and turned in between the chamfered wooden gateposts surmounted by cast-iron lamps, which marked the approach to the Welland Villa. Lights were already shining through its windows, and Archer, as the carriage stopped, caught a glimpse of his father-in-law, exactly as he had pictured him, pacing the drawing-room, watch in hand, and wearing the pained expression that he had long since found to be much more efficacious than anger. The young man, as he followed his wife into the hall, was conscious of a curious reversal of mood. There was something about the luxury of the Welland house and the density of the Welland atmosphere, so charged with minute observances and exactions, that always stole into his system like a narcotic. The heavy carpets, the watchful servants, the perpetually reminding tick of disciplined clocks, the perpetually renewed stack of cards and invitations on the hall table, the whole chain of tyrannical trifles binding one hour to the next, and each member of the household, to all the others, made any less systematized and affluent existence seem unreal and precarious. But now it was the Welland house and the life he was expected to lead in it that had become unreal and irrelevant. And the brief scene on the shore when he had stood irresolute halfway down the bank was as close to him as the blood in his veins. All night he lay awake in the big chintz bedroom at May's side, watching the moonlight slant along the carpet, and thinking of Ellen Olenska driving home across the gleaming beaches behind Beaufort's trotters.